Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's May 28th, 2017, and welcome to episode 153 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and some other things that I cannot remember. Okay, so we are here again with a crowd of retro computing enthusiasts. And first we have, in Canada, Carrington Vanston. How are you, Carrington?
I'm first!
You're first.
First! That's going to be my whole comment. I'm done now.
Okay. great. All right. And sticking with the Commonwealth, down in Australia, we have Michael Mulhern. How are you doing?
I am great. Thank you very much for asking. And so of all the people who lost, I came first. Yay, second.
Hooray. I skipped myself. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston. And then scooting on over to the other end of the North American continent, we have Kevin Savitz. How are you doing?
Hello, hello. Very well, thank you.
All right. So it is about to be in the U.S. anyway, I guess, Memorial Day. So I thought that today the topic could be just reminiscing about RAM limitations. So early on in home personal computing, we were faced with very real RAM constraints. So unlike my laptop now where I can just add gigabytes and really all that changes is how much it has to swap off the disk. RAM constraints were serious back in those early days. And so I just thought maybe this would be an interesting time to talk about what we remember about bumping into RAM limits, planning programs around them, finding failures, expanding RAM in our early computers, and that sort of thing. I don't know if anybody has any actual stories of that sort, but I'll continue with the order I had before. And Carrington, do you have any memories at all of memory?
First, yes, I do. Oddly, I bumped into RAM limits, and it became more of like an issue in computing, not with my earliest computers, with the Apple II and anything I had before that. It really never seemed like it'd be much of an issue, other than if I was working on a large word processing document. But for playing games, for just hacking around, for the most part, what I was doing was hobbyist things, and they were all designed for the computer as it existed. I typically had the higher end of RAM available, say we got like 64K RAM, but there were still things targeting 16K, so it never seemed to be a big deal. It was the movement to a GUI that made all of this be an issue. It's when I went to the Macintosh, suddenly the computer wanted a ton of RAM just to show me pretty pictures of my stuff before I started using it. And I love the pretty pictures. I was hooked from day one when I saw a Mac. But having to allocate RAM, and especially early on with the Mac, having to decide for myself how much RAM I would give a given application. Like you can open up and you would say, here's how much RAM you get when you launch. And it was a very manual process, much different than today. And also, those were the first computers I had that were doing swapping out to hard drive. So it's like, oh, isn't this wonderful? You can use your hard drive as extra RAM in a sense. but the hard drive will be a crazily slow spinning platter. Like it's just, I still can't get my head around the idea that for most of my computing life, it's been rapid spinning magnetic disks is actually how I save data. And I was okay with that. And I would go to sleep and I would sleep fine. And for some reason, I thought this was an acceptable way to work for crazy nonsense that I bought into. But the idea was, hey, you run into RAM. Well, that's okay. We'll just page out to your hard drive. Why don't you go make a cup of tea while I do that? It was crazy slow. And so that's when it was back then in that sort of middle period of computing where throwing a bunch of RAM at a computer could make a significant difference. But now, essentially, I've moved into that third phase of computing where it's a lot of solid-state stuff and it's solid-state hard drives, and things are swapping out really quickly. RAM has become cheaper as well. I've seemingly lost the ability to add RAM to anything that used to be something I liked. Why did my people who make the computers I purchase stop giving me that option? I like that option. Stop it, suppliers. but anyway, so that's it. It was that middle period, early Mac, hands-on, bumping into RAM ceilings because I was having to allocate stuff for, hey, Photoshop, you get this much, and all that manual stuff. And frankly, I wasn't very good at it. I'm not a very smart man. It's better now that that's been taken out of my hands.
Yeah, I totally forgot actually about that middle period, but you're right. There was a time when it became very salient and actually super frustrating when, you know, why is the Finder taking up all this space? I don't, you know, trying to curate your control panels and stuff so that it would not, you know, take up that extra 4K or whatever.
And I had RAM Dumbler. I don't know if you know that, but it was like a thing. I knew something had double RAM.
Yeah.
Kind of.
I got too many extensions running. I have to reboot with the shift key held down so that I have more RAM available.
Right, exactly. It's yeah, I remember RAM Doubler. I remember that was pretty wild. I think that was just, wasn't that just a alternative virtual memory?
It was magic.
Or was it compressing?
Don't spoil it for me.
I think it was basically swapping out. Yeah, it was VM.
But very cool. Yeah. Michael, what thoughts do you have about memory constraints?
Well, memory constraints, they kind of hit me fairly early on. My first introduction to programming on a personal computer was a Apple II Euro Plus with 48K. Now, that's quite a large amount of RAM compared to some of the other machines of the day. But that was alleviated somewhat when we put the 16K language cards in. That was pretty good on the hardware side. But I remember that on quite a few programs, I kept bumping into the high-res graphics area of the RAM. And, you know, everything worked fine until suddenly your program went into high-res graphics, and then suddenly part of your basic program disappeared or got corrupted. It was very disconcerting. And one of the ways I got around that is that I would work out the last line number before the start of high-res, and then I would put in a whole pile of REM statements to take me past that, and then my program would continue on through until it could bump into the upper limit. So it was quite a bit of tweaking, sort of, you know, you would edit your program below the high-res section of RAM, and suddenly half a line would pop back up in there. How much do I put comments in? So lots of fun and games, ducking and weaving around the memory mapping on the original Apple II. But you mentioned RAM Doubler. I used to use on my Windows 3.1.1 days memory management tools and other bits and pieces, Magna RAM for the RAM management. But one that was not RAM, but sort of related that I was using was some software that would do an inline compression of programs on the hard drive, and it would then decompress them on the fly. So, you know, for DLLs and programs and other text files that you weren't using commonly, they were compressed inline on the massive 20 megabyte hard drive. And if they got old enough, it would actually switch them out to removable media. So I remember where my 311 machine was compressed RAM, RAM management, compressed programs on the hard drive, and then other programs being removed from the hard drive and just leaving a stub behind, so that if you, say, went to start solitaire.exe, it would say, please insert floppy disk number 15. And would retrieve it from that floppy disk, and then you would play it. So while I was off getting my cup of tea, I was also making some scones.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Is that it seems like this is before we discovered that our time is also worth money.
Yes.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, it was one way of having everything to hand or easily accessible. Might not have been effective or efficient, but it was easy.
Yeah. Yeah, there was something called Disk Doubler by the same people. I'm trying to remember now. Yep. Who it was. Was that Alsoft or I don't know. But there was, yeah, there was a couple of these things for the Mac as well, doing the same things you're talking about. Kevin.
Hi.
What RAM memories do you have?
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
No, you ran a game show for us a long time ago, right?
That's true.
Yeah. Maybe again, too.
Yeah, maybe again. We'll see. It's going to be good this year. It's going to be good. You know, I think RAM limitations, I have a different take on it. In the early days of home computing, you know, when you could, maybe your Atari came with 16K, and it was possible to upgrade it to 48K, and I know, you know, the sort of, same sort of thing with the Apple II, the limitation for many people was money. Like, yeah, you could fill it with 48K or 64 or whatever, but man, that was going to cost you, you know, so the limitation was cash.
Three cheers for the university.
Sure.
Right.
I built a computer a couple of months ago. First time I'd built a PC in a while. It's a Hackintosh. It's very cool. And in this one, I mean, I've got 2 gigabytes of RAM in it, 2 or 4, I don't know. And only half the slots are filled now. And I could have kept going, but it seemed like I already had, and I bought the 2 4 gigs, whatever it is. There's a ridiculous amount of RAM in there. I could have kept going, but it would have been more than I could possibly use. And so the limitation, again, on the amount of RAM I have is money. I would be wasting money if I kept filling it with RAM.
So, Kevin, you're saying I didn't have to put 48 gigs into my PC?
No, you didn't need to. You don't.
Ah, oh, okay.
Yeah, you don't have to forever quote stuff. Kevin as 2 gigs is all you need.
Right.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll take my answer offline.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Yeah, I mean, I guess the sorts of things I was thinking about myself were a little bit like what Michael was mentioning with the sort of the dance you have to do with the RAM on these the early systems like the Apple II, that there is RAM, but there are these spots that you have to avoid. You know, see how you have like half a page here. If you're not going to use certain kind of graphics, you have, you know, a chunk here, you know, if you're going to use DOS, you have to stop early. And another thing I was thinking about was, you could get these like 1 meg, 4 meg, you know, RAM cards for these computers. But the thing is that in order to, like, the computer doesn't know how to use it. The operating system doesn't know how to use it. You have to, you know, you actually have to like craft a program to check to see if it's there, and then use it specifically. It's all a very different kind of world. So, anyway, but yeah, I mean, I guess I really didn't. I don't have any particular RAM expansion stories. I don't think I ever, you know, I sort of. In fact, actually, I had a 64K machine that I, you know, Apple II back in those days that I pretty much used like a 48K one because I didn't really know how to deal with that extra 12 or 16 that there was. So
yeah, just one more on there with the programming was, even though some systems, early systems I programmed on, allowed for long variable names, it was shortening your variable names down to 1 character or 2 characters, which of course is all the Apple II would let you effectively use anyway. But if you know, if you had a long variable name, you were using up bytes of your program storage. So you had to trade off in there from meaningful variable names to actually having some space to actually run the program without meaningful names.
That's right. And take out all the comments.
No program has ever needed more than 26 variables.
That's true. Legit.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think also multiple statements on one line, you know, can save you space. And never, ever, at least with, I don't know if this is true of general Microsoft basics, but in AppleSoft, there's never any point of putting the variable after next. You can say like for i equals 0 to 10, next, and it will just know that you meant next i.
That's some advanced stuff there, man.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Save the bytes.
There's actually this reminded me of a blog post that I saw quite a while ago. It's from 2008, but it's called Real Life Tron on an Apple 2GS, and it's talking about this sort of like making a little Tron game where, you know, it's like it's a snake game basically, or whatever, light cycles where you're sort of driving around trying to dodge people's trails and stuff, and there was an issue in the programming of this game where, and of course we all remember Tron, you know, it's all about like kind of like being transported into the internals of a computer and like, you know, whatever, fighting with other programs and so forth. It turned out that there was like a boundary checking error or something in this game, such that if you drove the light cycle off the edge of the screen, it would just sort of keep going.
Into RAM
and crash the computer.
That's how you crash the master control program right there.
it's a pretty hilarious little read. So I'll put a link in there to that. But
that sounds like an incredibly good maze game idea. Try to get your character out of this computer.
Right, without crashing.
In a way that doesn't take it down.
Very cool. All right. Okay, so I will move on now to a little bit of listener feedback that we got. On episode 150, we had we mentioned a vinyl single, I guess, by Bill Deal, who... it was an eBay auction, I think, and it said on it that it was a 2E was used to create it. And I guess Jonas bought it or had one, and he recorded it. And we'll drop in a little fair use-y sample of the Bent Brandenburg song here. And Jonas is actually attempting to contact Bill Deal now to ask about putting it online in full in some way. But he did send us the recording technique stuff on the liner notes. It says the string sounds were stored into an Apple IIe computer on Mimetic's new Metatrack 5.0 software using the latest classic CMS board, which is CMS's computer music system. Mountain Hardware made that first, and then I guess Mimetic's made an upgraded version of that called GeneSys. But anyway, if you're into music hardware on the Apple II computers, all other sounds were stored into the Apple IIe using the Passport MIDI 8 Plus software. The Apple was connected via MIDI to an EMU drumulator and the Yamaha DX7. I've actually been kind of, just as a side note, been looking at, I've been trying to find a cheap DX7 because I wound up with a program and a MIDI card that allows you to sort of add to the sound library. Kevin, do you know these things at all?
No, I don't.
You're a music person. Mm-hmm. Okay. anyone else? There, I think there's some kind of like very like legendary 80s, you know.
Oh, I'm familiar with it. I mean, I think it's a FM synthesis keyboard from mm-hmm. 80s. Yeah, it says 83 here.
Right.
Yeah, it's very cool.
I mean, I think they weren't super expensive. They were sort of like middle of the line, I think. But I think everybody had them because of that. I knew somebody in high school that had one. And anyway... you know, since I happened across this library management, you know, it's a sample management thing. Now I need one of these things, but I don't know exactly. There is actually a little, I'm getting way off track now, but there's a little thing that doesn't actually have a keyboard connected to it that serves as a sequencer, and it's called a TX7 and uses all the same, you know, it's got the same stuff in it, except it doesn't have the keys. And I think that's what I'm hoping to get. But anyway,
cool.
So, oh yes, and here is a little bit of Bent Brandenburg. Let me just say that even one more time.
I just want you to say fair use-y again. is that Gary Busey's sister or what?
I hope so. but yes, okay, so here it is. There it was. Okay. We'll, you know, update you if that actually makes it on online somewhere. But
I found a site that lists the various synthesizers used in TV and film. Uh-huh. And so during all of that, I was just kind of look up. I wanted to see if that synthesizer you're talking about was the one used in Revenge of the Nerds. It was not.
Okay.
That turns out to be a Roland CR5000. And so now I know that.
Those are high-end, I think. Roland and Moog and stuff. Yamaha does not make the high-end ones.
So if we're going to form a band, though, that might be the way to go.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, here we are.
I got a friend who wants to create a band. I'm saying that you can't have this. I'm not putting this out there because we might do this. He wants to start a band where we use old vintage synthesizers to play, you know, 80s music, OMD and that sort of thing. And he wants to call the band Casio Pequeño, which I think is
nice.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Mi Casio es su Casio.
Sí. Muy bueno.
And okay, so moving on, David wrote to so we talked about the Ohio Systems OSI, I don't know, Ohio Superboard 2 last time, I think, and he wrote to say he was an OSI owner back then, still has his original Challenger 2 4P, and pointed out a bunch of stuff on osiweb.org, which after I dug around a little bit on it, I think this is his site. So if you want manuals and other information, there's all kinds of stuff on osiweb.org. There's also a forum, and on the forum there's some discussions of reproductions of the OSI 600, which is the Superboard 2, and the 610, which is the RAM and floppy interface, and I think the 610 is the thing that I didn't understand what it was in the auction, but my guess is that that's what it is, and it sort of sits atop the 600. Kevin, wait, you built a Superboard 2, didn't you? Like a Superboard 3.
I did. Is that the thing I built at Kansas Fest that time? And I haven't touched since?
So.
Yeah. It's about 4 feet away, and it's been sitting in the bag I brought it home in since Kansas Fest like 2 years ago. Yeah. Almost 3 years
Excellent.
Ago now. Yeah. No, it was a fun project to build, and I've completely not touched it since then.
I can understand that. But anyway, so there are some Gerber files and PCBs available for replicas, reproductions. Basically, anything Ohio Scientific has been at least considered for reproduction. There's scans and Gerber files and things all discussed in these forums. So if you are interested in this, check that out.
All right. I've now touched the Superboard 3 for the first time in almost 3 years. Superboard, yeah. Is it? And it's you're right. It's very cool. And I can put it back away.
All right. Excellent.
There's a bunch of other stuff in this bag that apparently has been in here since Kansas Fest two or 3 years ago.
That could be a new segment. Kevin opens a bag.
Yeah. We could do that every day for like a year, and that would be an amazing podcast. And my office would get cleaned.
Yeah, I was thinking that actually might not be a bad strategy for my own sort of like cleaning. Just sort of just go through, make a little 10 minute thing of everything I pick up. It's like, all right, here's why I have this. Here's why, you know, when I got it, what it's for. I will now get rid of it.
Yeah, I've got some sort of board in Mylar. This looks like something that I purchased. I should not be allowed to have money or go places because this was just clearly not a good use of... it's some sort of red board in a static.
Or maybe it's something you won. You won one of the Hackfest things.
Maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that was your prize.
Let's find out. Let's see if I can get this thing open.
Yeah, the last... was it last time I won a sort of like a participant award?
Yeah.
Was it a little ribbon?
I went to a... I'm trying to open this live on the air, but I'm actually having trouble. I went to a TI festival in Washington a couple weeks ago, Texas Instruments 99-4A thing, and I won the grand prize there, and I felt like such a jerk. I don't really use TIs, and, you know, I just showed up to see what was going on, and you know, I won the grand prize. It's like, later suckers, bye.
Humble brag much.
Felt like a jerk. All right, I was going to open but...
I'm a really big deal in TI circles.
Yeah, I'm not a big deal in TI circles, and I don't deserve their prizes.
It's only the ones from Kansas Fest.
I deserve those.
Right. Okay. So are we still trying to open something?
I am. I'm.
It's the childproof wrappings defeated him again.
Camelia, bring me some scissors, will you?
That's the name of your new podcast. Camellia, bring me some scissors.
I don't even know if she heard me. All right. Well, continue on the show, and if I get this open, I will report back shortly.
All right. Sounds good. Well, I'll just mention quickly, Yorma wrote in raising the question of people making and selling sort of close reproductions that are labeled as reproductions, but, you know, still they're labeled as reproductions in the auction that sells them to you, but not, you can't really tell not so well on the item itself. And I only wanted to say that, see episode 142, we had this as a host topic. Rather than re-say everything now.
So we're not going to reproduce it here?
No.
I know this is ridiculous, okay. But I remember where I was walking the dog when I listened to that discussion.
Right. And then the last thing I wanted to mention, this isn't actually feedback exactly, but this is kind of a public service announcement. The Musée Bolo, do you guys know this at all? This museum in Switzerland?
No, it's just that to me, Bolo is basically a super intelligent tank.
That's my thoughts exactly.
They have a big collection of a lot of interesting stuff, and they had basically a spot in a museum in Switzerland, and they're no longer basically able to stay there. The museum can't supply the space anymore. And apparently they didn't get a whole lot of lead time on this. So there's basically they're doing a fundraiser to try to first find a place to store stuff, you know, like to store all the stuff that's there, and then later to come to sort of set up a new space in, and they've already got one identified, I think, in Lausanne, I think it said. Lausanne, Switzerland. So it's worth taking a look at. I think they could definitely use support in this. And it's an impressive collection. It's well curated. It's huge. It would be
is an understatement. I'm looking at the photo on here, on the site of what essentially is, I guess, a warehouse. It right. looks like what I've always imagined Paul's office to be. Right. Like it's just, or if you're going to hide the Ark from Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it would happen to actually be a retro computer, this is where you put it. This is massive.
Yeah. 5,000 computers and video game consoles, 8,000 software units, I guess, 15,000 books and magazines. I mean, I honestly have no idea what happens if they can't get a storage space for this, but I mean, it does seem like they need help.
We'll put it on eBay and Paul will buy all of it.
Yes. Anyway. Well, the sad thing, you know, like I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, oh, I have that. I have that. Oh, I have one of those. But
I got the bag open. Do you want to know what it is?
Oh, ooh.
I know you've been waiting with bated breath. It is an Apple II Pi. I think it's a gadget that lets you hook a Raspberry Pi into your Apple II.
Yeah, those are, they're actually, you can't get them right now.
I just reach 5 feet away and open a random bag and I can get them.
Yeah, they're sort of in between revisions. They're doing some kind of modification to it and you can't get them anymore. And that's been true for quite a while. But it's basically sort of like a serial card that you mount a Raspberry Pi on. So it kind of directly can communicate and you can use your Apple II as a terminal to the outside world and stuff. It's a pretty cool thing.
Cool. Well, nifty.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yay. I feel like a winner all over again.
Yeah. It reminds me of when the Raspberry Pi was new, I thought, oh, I have to get one of these because it's a cheap little computer, you know, right? And but the thing is that they're sold out everywhere. So I spent a bunch of money, actually more than, you know, like I spent too much on one on eBay so I could get one right away. And then I didn't touch it for like a year and a half.
And meanwhile, it would have come out with two new versions.
Yeah, right, exactly. I have several now, but anyway. Okay, so that's listener feedback. And now we can move on to items of interest and news. And Carrington, you have the first one.
Oh, I'm interested in The Treasure of Lumos, which is a new ZX Spectrum game. How cool is that? So it's by Jamie. I'm going to think it's Grillo because it's one L, but it might be Jamie Grillo. Sorry if I pronounced your name wrong. It's a manic miner type game. Looks really cool. I've always been a big fan of those bright colors from the ZX Spectrum, and so this delivers those in spades. There's the site we'll link to will let you download the .tap file, which I guess is the thing you can run. I'm out of the ZX Spectrum loop. It also has a video, which I watched. The way I played this game is I watched the video walkthrough, and it was quite fun. So I sort of turned this into a Let's Play, and I just watched that. And while the sounds are a little garish, so don't crank up the speaker, I think such is the way with the ZX Spectrum. So, but really cool. Well implemented game. Looks super awesome. I was very impressed. And so I thought we'd kick off the links by saying, hey, there's a new game. So if you got one of these fancy ZX Spectrums or an emulator there's something. Download it, play it, enjoy.
Cool.
Yeah, I just love those hyper vibrant colors.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much the sound,
like the cyans and yellows, and yeah, love them.
I think I've probably said this like several times on the podcast, but I had a BBC Micro at one point, and that's sort of what I liked about it too. There's something just sort of special about these colors that. Everything
where
else.
You have to wear sunglasses.
Yeah, like Atari's more muted. The Apple's more muted as well. Commodore's
and more
muted.
Fringed.
There's, I don't know what it is exactly, but there is something that's just really like primary.
The other thing that's
those.
always struck me as weird, well, kind of endearing and cool about it, is the way that having never programmed a Spectrum, it seems that you define an area of a screen like a block and say this will be in this color. And then you draw your dots. So any given little square only has a single color in it. And what's neat about that is if you have your, in this case, your little avatar running around, and let's say she's white, and then she moves onto the ladder, well, now she's yellow, because the yellow's her ladder. So all the ZX Spectrum games to me feel like old school arcade games that got their color by cellophane overlays.
Right.
So it's just like when you look through this part of the screen, you will see yellow regardless of what's there. And I just find that really endearing. I like the cellophane overlay approach to colors.
All right, I will move on to the next item. Kevin, you have
that's me.
Whatever the next thing is. Oh yes,
Radio Shack. I heard is. I mean, I know you've talked many times on this show about the demise of Radio Shack, and it. I guess it just continues. They're going to shutter more than over 1,000 stores this weekend. This Memorial Day weekend, they're shutting them down. But what I thought was super interesting is they are doing an auction of the Radio Shack archives, which if you are even a little bit interested in Radio Shack and TRS-80 stuff, this is worth a look. They have more than 700 items, and they're pretty incredible. The first thing I did, of course, is I searched this thing for TRS-80, and there's more than 40 things that specifically mention TRS-80. There's Model 3s and Model 4s. There's color computers. But then if you just start digging around and just looking around, there's just amazing stuff. Troves of every Radio Shack catalog in neatly, you know, collated binders. Art from apparently the walls of the Radio Shack offices, all sorts of different receivers and answering machines and things, newsletters, TRS-80 newsletters from Australia, and catalogs and pins, like collections of pins that you would get for meritorious service for working at Radio Shack, and then bicycles apparently that they use to ride around the campus in Texas. It's so cool. I mean, and it's kind of sad, but somebody who's the right people who are into TRS-80, this is your time right now. There's some amazing stuff in this auction.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. I took a look through this as well. I mean, there's some of the stuff I just can't figure out, like plates and tables and things like this that seem from a living room set. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what connection that had to Radio Shack, except maybe somebody just had it in the storage space.
Seems to me if some of the auctions go for low enough bids, this could be the key to the most epic dorm room decoration at Kansas Fest ever. To turn your room into a Radio Shack.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. 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 And these things are, I mean, all of these auctions end in 36 days from now, so not until, I guess, beginning of July. So I think, I mean, this is done like by a professional auction house, estate sale sort of place. So they're not fooling around. They know what they're doing, and they're going to get maximum value out of this stuff. But it's going to be interesting to watch, see what happens.
At least all the ones that I've looked at, they have sort of anti-sniping policy there. So essentially, mm-hmm. if there's a bid within the last, I think, 2 minutes or something, then the time is extended. But yeah, there's a couple. There's a bust of Charles Tandy that you can get.
I didn't see that. That's awesome. I didn't see that. I saw like a framed portrait of George W. Bush, which seemed appropriate for a Texas company like this.
And, you know, so a fair amount of this stuff is from kind of like newer era. But there's also a big, like a large plastic sign in the older Radio Shack style that I sort of remember with I don't even know how to describe it, but the letters that have kind of like little circles in them and stuff. But yeah, I think I'm a little disappointed. It's very interesting. But I sort of feel like the people who put these together, didn't know the stuff. I mean, like often a lot of these things have like, it says box of miscellaneous software and there's a one picture mm-hmm. of the top. Right. So you can see one thing on top.
And you know, at that box, there's source code. You know, there's going to be operating system source code or just something that's completely wonderful. And you just can't know until you buy it.
Right.
So, yeah. And this is, and it's, you know, computers and laptops and this and that. And then literally, it's just like a box of plates and paper towel holders and things, you know, from the lunchroom or, you know, whatever. So, people who don't know and don't care what the stuff is, it's just their job to sell it. So that's what they're doing.
Yep. Yep. But it is starting at pretty low bids. I mean, it looks like everything's, I don't even know if there are minimums, but
no, I don't think there's minimums for anything.
Cause I'm seeing a lot of these things with like $3 bids. So cool. All right. Michael, you have the next thing.
Oh, I should stop browsing the.
He's placing bids for TRS-80s.
Yeah, sorry, I was just registering for an auction house.
I did that yesterday. I have several things on my watch list.
Okay, the first thing I thought I'd have a look at for today's show was what was happening 5 years ago on RCR. Now, so that was episode 28, back on the 2nd of June, 2012. And I just thought I'd sort of see what was being talked about and links that were still there. So the one that interested me was the 6502 emulated in Minecraft. So we keep seeing fun stuff in Minecraft. But the one which I would really make room for downstairs here is the Arkeg, arcade cabinet and beer keg chiller. So...
I have a question. Is make room for downstairs an Australian slang for something?
Yeah, I was kind of wondering this myself.
Oh, ha ha. Hardy ha. Yes, the link doesn't work, but a little bit of Googling finds this wonderful upright arcade cabinet. And underneath is a small keg CO2. So nice chiller setup and your gas and your tap on the side. So a drink and game.
If you can make it run Apple IIgs stuff, it could also run kegs.
Right, exactly. Very cool.
I was always trying to figure out why they named it after a kegs for beer. I just have never been able to figure out how it connects up to the chiller and the gas. So I don't know. Maybe someone could explain kegs to me. But this would look great down here and be an excellent addition to a retro get-together. It's just the price. I think it was around $4,000. Uh-huh. Yeah, is it worth $4,000 US? Probably not. I don't know. Depends on how much you like your arcade games and beer, all in one.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of a curve. You know, like you get slightly better at the games, and then you get dramatically worse. as the beer consumption goes on.
WKRP in Cincinnati thing. Maybe just get better and better and better.
Yep. So yeah, there's a 25-year anniversary of HyperCard. Play Wolfenstein 3D online. So things haven't changed that much. But there was also an eBay auction, and this is what got me. An eBay auction for a Apple One, which looked like it went for around $75,000. So those were the days where you could have conceivably bought at auction an Apple One. Not so much these days.
That was also back in the days when Carrington hosted.
Yeah.
Yes.
The bad old days. I would sell you all for magic beans.
That was Carrington, David, and Earl.
So, who are those guys?
Yeah. Oh, David, by the way, just interviewed on Mac Observer's background mode. So if you want to hear what's going on with David recently, we'll put a link in the show notes for that.
And the other one, which I was just going to mention here, is it seems that Charles Babbage was a very careless and forgetful man, as well as getting involved in the early days of computers. He left a program lying around in Turin in 1840. So here's a link to a Wired article where basically someone probably reached into a bag which was just lying around and rummaged around inside it, and out came some what are basically punch cards. So there's not much more to the article than that. So obviously Charles Babbage was an early ancestor of Kevin Savitz, and just left things lying around for to be found at a later date.
Nice.
But yeah, it's unclear. Unfortunately, there's no information about like how they're read. There was one type of card was a number representer, and then the other type of card was something less obvious, but some kind of...
Yeah.
Well, these would have been for the analytical engine, which never actually came into existence, right? So they would have been just like hypothetical stuff.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true.
What I found really interesting is looking at the card, the way the punch works, that it punches... Basically, you punch out the numbers that would be left over from 10 or from 0 through 9. It's weird. So, like, looking at how it's punched, you think if you were 1 or 2, you would punch 2. It's like, no, you'd punch 8, because that tells you that. It's punch from the top down. It's very odd way to do a punch card.
And it was also basically an early homage to U.S. elections, because those cards have got some hanging chads.
Yeah, they did mention that. That was part of the reason why they were thinking these might never have been used for anything. But did you notice it was who wrote it? Bruce Sterling apparently is the person who wrote this article.
He would know a little bit about the difference engine?
Yes, exactly. That's what I was going to just point out. He co-wrote the difference engine.
We should also point out that it's an article on Wired, which is a site that will love to run lots of things from other people on your computer. So if you have a content blocker, it'll go, whoa, I don't think so. So the key to look at things on Wired is to load them up. And before you click anywhere, just click on, like, if you're in Safari, click on reader mode. It gets rid of all that crap and won't load it in and let you view it even with a content blocker. So.
Ah, interesting. Cool.
Because otherwise, Wired can bite me. I won't let it run that stuff.
All right. So I guess I have the next thing. The thing I wanted to talk about is something that I discovered actually as I was coming in. I was listening to Antic, and they already talked about this, but so Kevin can help me out here.
I hear that's a great podcast.
Yeah. You're right. But so there are a couple of different projects that they're trying to become sort of like modern Atari 800s or Atari 8-bits. There's a couple different ways that this is being approached. So, but I think they're both aiming to fit in a mini ITX kind of form. So like a Mac Mini type sized thing. So there's a one of them is 1088XEL, which is a mini ITX motherboard that someone's been working on for quite some time. There's kind of like an extended thread on the I think it's the Atari Age forum. Yep. And essentially the idea here is that it takes something like 5 of the original Atari chips, the from a real Atari, and then puts a bunch of support stuff around it that will allow you to use SD cards and, you know, modern video out and that sort of thing. And it looks... So I'm not actually sure what the ultimate status of it is. I think it's now sort of like created and working. I don't know if you can get one. I think the price is unknown at this point, but it's an interesting project. And So I guess I wanted to pair that also with another one that's kind of like when you think about this and you think, oh, well, okay, I'm going to have to get a bunch of chips out of an Atari now to do this. You think, well, all right, well, couldn't you do this with an FPGA? And of course, there are people who are doing that as well. And so there's something called the Eclair XL, which is kind of the same kind of project, except with FPGA instead. So instead of actually using any of the original Atari chips, it's all FPGA. But I think it actually has connections that will allow it to connect to real Atari peripherals and things. So neither of these, so both of them are in late stages of development. I don't think either of them are actually available, but do you know if that's true, Kevin?
I believe that's accurate.
Okay. But they're both interesting projects.
Yes,
indeed. And I don't know. I'm kind of curious to see where they go. I mean, I wonder about the first one that uses the Atari chips, the 1088 XEL, which is the one that kind of is, I don't know, came to my attention most recently, is, and I think it's just because the Hackaday article is somewhat recent, but I wonder, I mean, you know, first of all, it does require cannibalizing. It isn't emulation, at least, you know, so it's an actual real thing, but at the same time, these things are going to fail. So I don't know what I think about this. I think it's an interesting engineering project, at least. Well, so Kevin, I think actually, as I recall, thinking back to my ride over here, it wasn't actually, you didn't discuss it too much on Antic. You sort of mentioned it, but what do you think about this?
I think it's, I mean, I love this sort of thing. I'm glad, I always love it when people are making new hardware that works like old hardware, because that old hardware is not going to last forever. And, you know, if it ends up being just a one-off for him, then okay, great, excellent. And if it manages to become a product, then, you know, I'll be first in line. And that sounds like fun. I don't know what else to say other than yay Atari.
Yeah. I think, you know,
that's not how you say boo.
Reading the thread is actually kind of interesting too. There's a lot of fairly deep analysis going on of, you know, like people looking at the traces on the board and realizing, oh, there was a error in the Atari schematics
nerds,
you know, a couple different people have fallen victim to. And I don't know, so even if it is a one-off board for this guy, you know, the community academic exercise was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, okay. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, like this kind of thing for other platforms as well. I know Amiga, the Amiga Mist project is not unlike this.
Right. I mean, that's there are new Amiga hardware that you can buy today. I think that's probably a sort of similar thing, although that's a company that still exists, or someone actually cares about that IP. So, there's like a real, quote unquote, real company making that.
That's actually one of the things that's always a little strange about Amiga is that, you know, unlike all of the other platforms, people actually are trying to get, you know, licenses for the Kickstart thing. And, you know, it's laudable, but I don't know. I kind of like not having to worry about that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So.
All right, Carrington, let's begin the controversy.
War. Here we go.
Flame war. Flame war.
Something turned 30. And I can guess what
that
it is.
Pronounced GIF, you noobs. Soft G, baby.
Which is,
No, you're a hard G guy?
Yeah.
You don't look 12.
I thought G was a soft G and J was a hard G. Now I need to start arguing about what is a hard and what is a soft G.
Yes. No, I think, you know, I've always pronounced it in my head, you know, like from when I first saw it written down as GIF, but...
It's GIF. Know. It's GIF. And we'll get it for its 30th birthday, we'll get it a gift, not a gift.
That's right. Right.
You make me want to drink gin. I get that, all you newbies, drives me crazy. Yes, you read a thing. Lots of us I dated a girl once who pronounced Zaphod Beeblebrox as Zaphod Beeblebrox. Because she, you know, hadn't heard the radio programs, and so she learned a word the way many of us do by reading it first. But then once she found out how it was actually pronounced, she realized she was in error, and she changed the pronunciation. I know you Americans want to say foyer, so you'll stick to your guns when you make a mispronunciation, but whatever. It's Jif. Anyway.
We're all just misled by the representation on the page.
Right. So basically, this is my excuse to bring up the dancing baby images and the under construction signs. So the internet was filled with under construction signs early on because of this wonderful format. The thing is, regardless of all the arguments about people like getting it right or getting it wrong or what have you, it's a very neat thing, and it's an important image format that was, you know, created by basically one dude, what is his name, Steve Gleheit, who did it for CompuServe, because at the time, a whole bunch of computers, various platforms were all connecting to CompuServe, and it needed an image format that you could save an image in a file format that all of these various computers could display, and they could display them quickly over very slow internet connections. Like maybe they got 300 baud modems, and something that, unlike a JPEG, could be, like in this article, it talks about how it needs to be maybe things like stock quotes and stuff that can't be all JPEG-y. And it was an amazingly successful and still existing image format that is still popular, and also therefore went on in the internet and gave us the under construction signs and dancing babies and stuff. But still, pretty amazing that it did exist and it still existed. So I think it's a real success story. And it turned 30. May 1987 is when it came out.
I think my recollection of this format was that it took a while to really kind of make use of the multiple frame aspect of it. I mean, you know, for a while, I only knew of it as a single image format.
Me too.
Guys, remember when we all thought we'd have to stop using GIFs because of the patent thing?
Yeah, yeah.
And someone said they had a patent on it, and software would have to stop supporting it, and then. I don't know. Then the patent expired.
I don't really understand why that didn't. Yeah, it's possible. the community had them taken out.
Right. Yeah. Maybe the lawyers couldn't figure out how it was pronounced.
Yeah, maybe. That's right. Nothing to do with me.
They patented the wrong thing.
They went and put a cease and desist on the wrong product.
Yeah, maybe GIFs were blocked and nobody has ever used them. Mm, and right. It's just GIFs everywhere.
And now we only have GIFs.
Yeah.
I'm adding to the list, by the way, JPEG-y is going on the list with fair use.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to Kevin. You have the next thing.
Do I? My browser just crashed. And I had to, okay. I don't know what we're doing anymore. I'm sorry.
Turbo Basic XL.
Oh, Turbo Basic XL. So I almost didn't put this in because I thought it might be just too Atari geeky specific. But just a few days ago, but I'm doing it anyway because... Because I can. Just a few days ago, the source code for Turbo Basic XL was released, which is an Atari Basic, arguably. And I'm unlike GIF and Jif, I'm willing to argue this, but this may be the best version of Basic that was created for the Atari 8-bit computers. It was originally published in a magazine as object code, and it was just a great language with a lot of extensions and stuff, but compatible with Atari Basic. And basically, the source code was lost, and the guy who made the language was dead. And 31 years after the language was originally released, the source code has been available with the permission of the family of the programmer, and it's completely the complete original commented source code. And so, of course, what the Atari community is doing is, first, there was, you know, a party of overjoyedness, and now they're attacking it with like, okay, well, here's, you know, the little bugs, here's the little problems that we've known about for 20 years, let's fix them now, and, you know, here, what extensions can we do, and this and that. And this is not the first time this has happened even recently. I mean, last year, the source code for the Action programming language was released. And the same thing. It's like, oh, you know, there's a bug. If you, you know, do this and that, you can't divide by zero. Let's fix that, you know. So, and people go in and, you know, make a new version that fixes little problems and that sort of thing. And also, let's see what I'm thinking of last year. Source code for Star Raiders and like, oh, let's fix it so the explosions work better. And so it just make, this is the most recent one, Turbo Basic XL. And it just makes me so happy that people are still able to find the source code and release it. And then just dig in there and fix these, fix problems, fix bugs, extend the languages and that sort of thing. So yay.
Yeah. That's very cool. And you know, like thinking about this, it sort of feels like if this had not been done now, it might well never have happened. I mean, mm-hmm. like we've got to be getting on the tail end of the time when it's possible to do this.
I think so. I mean, when I do interviews and stuff, I talk to guys, I was going to say all the time, but that would not be true. But once in a while, I'll say, you know, do you have source code? And the guy will go, yeah, I've got the source code. Let me find it, you know? And if he hasn't moved too many times and the spouse hasn't made him throw it away and there hasn't been a flood in the basement and a million other things, some of these people save the source code and are willing to shave it. And that way, it's sort of a golden time right now, because really in the last couple of years, a lot of source has been discovered, uncovered, and saved. But man, in 10 years, you know, no, there's that many more guys who have died and that many more floods and people have moved to Florida and thrown out all their stuff. And, you know, this is a golden time right now, this moment. Mm.
It's one thing if they die, but if they move to Florida, you just can't recover from that.
Right.
Yeah. It does probably help that they're happening also, because that raises the profile. People say, oh yeah, someone, you know, it's interesting that you're interested in this. I have something that might also be interesting in the same way, you know?
Yeah. So
hopefully there's a kind of a snowball effect.
Right. I interviewed a guy recently and I don't want to say anything. I don't want to curse it, but I interviewed him and I'm like, do you have the source code? He's like, yeah, I think I do. And then I called him like a month later and said, you know, you said you'd look for the source code. He's like, yeah, there's way more than I thought. And it's a little overwhelming. It's like 3,000 disks. And I was just like, what? And it's source code for all different platforms. And it's all on 8-inch CPM disks. So it's a bit of a project. But just hold your breath and cross your fingers, because everybody wins if these disks are still good.
Yeah, that's I mean, just the fact that it's on 8-inch discs suggests history.
Yeah,
they're pronounced GIFs.
Go to your room. Had enough of you.
Is it a silent, soft, or heavy K in disc?
All right. Okay, Michael, you have the next.
Okay.
You and I actually have two short things, I think.
Yes. Okay. Quick one. The retro challenge for 2017-04 are in, and the winners have been announced. Won't run through all of them here, but there were some excellent prizes there. My favorite is by Ryan Walmsley, who his project was to build a Windows 98 gaming PC to play games that his compact 386 luggable can't. So there's okay, Windows 98. Yeah, I'll give that one that it's retro-y enough to do. And you know, it's gone through, you know, selecting motherboard, ISA, all the fun stuff. And everything was working perfectly fine until he applied unofficial service pack 3. All the menus he wanted to seem to view incorrectly, and it broke IE5 fully. So I agree with
That's
John
not
there.
Hard.
So Ryan did truly recreate a true 90s PC experience. Well done.
Very nice.
So, yeah, so some excellent projects there, some great wrap-ups. If you want to see what goes on in a retro challenge, click on over to the retro challenge and select from the menu to look at all the entries. There's the usual smattering of false starts and life gets in the way, but all in all, there are some great projects in there, and I highly recommend that you have a look and get inspired and join us for the October retro challenge.
Cool.
And there's another nice word in here in the write-up from John for Kevin. He has used retro challengey.
Yes, I saw that.
Yes. All right, that goes on the list. We've got JPEGy, Fair Use-y, and retro challengey. Writing that down right now.
All right. I had one other thing I just wanted to mention pretty quickly. So this was a write-up on Vintage is the New Old. There's a TRS-80 color basic syntax color plugin for the Atom editor. So if you're working on your modern machine with the my phone is telling me that some eBay auction is ending.
It's that bust of Charles Tandy, isn't it?
So it was, I don't even know what it was. Let's see. It was, oh yeah, Datamost Argos for the Apple II. But anyway,
I'm going to snipe it.
Well, we'll see in 13 minutes. But so yeah, Atom is, yeah, that's right. It does say here, it's the editor that's made by the people who do GitHub, you know, so they use this for their own programming. It's a pretty respectable programming editor. But somebody has, and you know, so you can get whatever C and Ruby and Perl and whatever, you know, Python, little syntax coloring plugins that will highlight your code in some sensible way. And someone has created a TRS-80 color basic plugin for Atom. And so there's a little write-up on that. And we'll have a link to the write-up and to the place on atom.io that you can get the plugin.
So. I hope it limits the colors to the garish colors that were available in Cocoa Basic.
I don't know. I don't know, actually. I suspect it probably doesn't, but it's still pretty cool that it's like it's doing this. So, all right, and I guess that's it for the very long first half, and now a word from our sponsor.
If you own a computer, here's how to get the most out of it without buying lots of expensive software. Get ready to write down a phone number and watch this. CompuServe combines the power of your computer with the convenience of your telephone to bring you hundreds of online services, like a complete set of encyclopedias and the AP Newswire. It helps you decide on investments, bank, make airline reservations, and shop in the electronic mall. It connects you with other computer owners and offers games that pit you against opponents around the country. You get all this and more, and it's as simple as making a local phone call. To get online with CompuServe and over 250,000 people throughout North America, see your local computer store or call 1-800-543-8000 to order direct or to receive a free illustrated guide to CompuServe. Call now to get the most out of your computer.
And we're back. Okay, so I am the host, and I am recovering from a cold, and I'm responsible for the retro computing gift idea. And so what I wanted to do was to...
Big box of NyQuil, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's for your retro computing enthusiasts, friends. No, in fact, actually, Michael brought up the episode 28 from 5 years ago, where one of the gifts, at that point, apparently the gifts... The gifts were being suggested by each host, but David's suggestion was a my first laptop plush playset, and it isn't exactly still being sold. There's an updated version being sold, so that is my
second
pick.
Laptop.
It's called My First Laptop Playset for Babies by Gund. The old one had a connected mouse and a CD-ROM. It's a little plush thing, right? But and the new one has a little like flash drive, a thumb drive, and a little SD card. So if you want...
It sounds like a choking hazard.
It's I don't know how big it is, actually.
Yeah, well, it's obviously too big for Kevin because it comes with a 6 GB RAM.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I don't quite understand. They instead of a mouse, they just have like... They have like
a mouse.
What appears to be
an actual mouse.
An actual stuffed mouse. And a dog that says 6 GB RAM on it. I don't understand that, but
well, it's not a dog, it's a ram.
Oh, that's it.
That makes a lot more sense, actually. I thought it was a dog too.
Oh, that cold's contagious.
All right,
it's killing RAM.
Although I got to say, Kevin, from now on, I'm going to refer to the Atari 800 and 400 series as plush. My first computer playset for babies. Yeah. I'm sorry, dude, but that's got to happen.
You're mean. I like you.
I'm super mean. That's mean with a cape.
It looks pretty cool. I might even.
I'm podcasting on one now.
But yeah, so it's it looks like it folds up. And anyway, it's $24 at a recommended for ages birth and up, which seems
birth. like, welcome to Earth. It's your computer. Get working.
That's right.
I don't know. After it's been through some small children, it's going to be riddled with viruses.
Oh, true. Anyway, okay, so we can now move on to other ways to spend money on eBay. And Carrington, you have the first one.
I do. Cool. Go me. What did I was picking? Oh, okay. My first one is a 1983. It's a different sort of 1983 computer. It's a thoroughbred horse race analyzer computer in a box, which is basically a calculator. But back then in the 80s, the way you sold calculators was you called them computers. So if you're going to be hitting the track 1980s style, then this little handheld computer, located in Canada, by the way, which is why I picked this one, tons of them on eBay, but it's a horse race analyzer. No doubt helps about as much as a lottery number picker would. But still, how cool. The weird thing about this particular auction is if you scroll through the photos and go to the very last one, it seems to come with a $31,000 vintage check, and I don't know why that's in there. I don't know if that was just in the box or something. So it looks like Maurice Zolotov didn't cash his $31,466.46 check in 1981. So if that check's still good, then this could be the bargain of a century, though.
Yeah, you know, just a few days ago, the Preakness race happened, and a horse called Cloud Computing won it. So I think there actually might be something through to this thoroughbred horse race analyzing computer, because clearly it took a while, but it worked.
It does. It takes a very long time, but it works.
Yeah, so it's perfect for a day at the races.
Yes, but yes. That day happens to be in 2030, apparently, if you want to do the next one. So that's my first choice, just like $20. There's a whole bunch of them on eBay, though, and I just thought it was a neat little vintage thing, and just as an example of the other sorts of computers that would be around in the 80s, or things called computers anyway. Second quick choice is a neat-looking book that includes a bunch of hints, maps, and solutions. It's called, in fact, Hints, Maps, and Solutions to Computer Adventure Games. There's a couple of these big format books that show up on eBay all the time. This isn't those. This is another one that I don't see up as often. $25 plus shipping. Shipping's pretty expensive up here in Canada. If you want to play these games and you're, like, say, a big fan of something like Eaten by a Crew, and you don't have access to the internet and yet somehow get the podcast, this might be a great way to get hints. I don't know. It's a neat little book. Other people like to have stuff. Here's a stuff you could have. And then my third choice is a quick add-on. There's Datamos Argos for the Apple II. I would highly recommend people go on and bid that to the sky for no reason.
Yeah. You have 6 minutes and 41 seconds.
So we'll be public.
Nicely done.
Currently has 5 bids. $16.50. We'll see who the winner is.
All right. Kevin, you have the next one.
I went to eBay and intentionally tried to find things for this part, this segment, that I would not want.
I do that all the time. That's my strategy.
So the first thing I did was I searched for mainframe, because I thought it would be A, relevant, and B, not really interesting, but not like interesting to me, you know? The thing that I find actually is somehow listed in the mainframe category, but it is not. But it's a personal computer that I was unfamiliar with, called a Pied Piper Communicator 1 computer. And this is a portable computer, complete. This one is complete in box, and it's got the wrapping and the disk drive and everything. It's from 1982. And apparently it was introduced at the CES or Promdex in 82. And it looks cool, and I've never heard of this thing before. And I like it, but I was right. I don't want it, even if it is a mainframe. Even if it's not a mainframe.
Portable computer in the sense that it is not bolted down.
Yeah.
And it's got a handle. But that's it. Like, it's just a computer. And you can, like, it's not a built-in screen or anything. It's not battery powered. It's literally just a desktop computer
right. That
they're calling a portable computer.
Yeah, I don't understand where the handle is. They have an ad at the end that shows, like, introducing the Pied Piper, and then there's a guy, like, walking with this, holding it by some handle. And then, of course, like, a bunch of business types kind of, like, following him blindly because he's got the Pied Piper.
Look at that jerk. Right. He's got no screen.
But in the auction, I couldn't see actually like where the handle is.
Yeah, it's the sixth photo in. I'm just trying to see if it's retractable.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I can see your knuckles getting damaged on that.
Yeah. I hate the logo as well. The fact that the D is the only letter that doesn't have the cut of stuff. That's just setting off my OCD.
But the D is weird. No, just the name Pied Piper is weird. I mean, why would you, marketing-wise...
It's full of rats.
...choose a name, you know, for a story where, there were rats, and then the person who did it didn't get what he wanted and stole all the children.
Or maybe it comes with a free mouse?
Maybe.
It comes with 1,000 free mice. They will fill your house with mice. Anyway, it's only $500, which is less than the original price. So, good deal.
Well, it's ideal.
It's cool though, and I had not heard of it either. But it was advertised in Byte. So, did you have another one?
I do. I don't love this one because it's Commodore. But again, I was trying to find things that I wouldn't personally want. Found a nice, this isn't anything amazing or anything, but it's a nice Commodore Plus 4 machine with the box and all the manuals. It looks completely complete for $80. Buy it now. And all I can say is at least it's not a 64.
Yeah, this actually does look nicer than many that I have seen. The box is in good shape. The thing is in good shape, but it's not, but no one would want one of these. I mean, I don't know if you know much about them, but I mean...
Yeah, no one would want this at all. It's useless.
The Plus 4 is for built-in applications that all are buggy and don't,
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyway. Now, I always had a question. To use a Commodore Plus 4, do you have to wear Plus 4s? Do you guys know what Plus 4s are?
Because I don't know what that is.
Ridiculous.
This is not
so
a thing
Plus 4s are... long knickerbockers. So knickerbockers are ridiculous pants that go to your knee, but if you have ridiculous pants that go 4 inches below your knee in a fancy 1930s style way, they look like oversized shorts that just go... Those are called Plus 4s. They are particularly ridiculous-looking breeches.
What are breeches?
Why Commodore picked that as a name, I have no idea. But anyway, so if your knickerbockers are too short...
You know many words for Canadian clothing that I just don't know what breeches are. Knickerbockers.
I'm dating a horse girl, so I know all about breeches. And,
breeches is different than breeches, isn't it?
Breeches is like American breeches. It's just a way of pronouncing it. So anyway, knickerbockers are baggy pants that go to your
don't
knees.
Don't burn your breeches before they're crossed.
Huh? Yeah.
All right.
Anyway, Plus 4s. Google it, folks. The ridiculous images
Michael.
Of silly 1930s plant.
Save us.
Well, you think I'm going to save us? Okay. Well, the first one I've got is a fairly complete, as in there's no monitor, Dick Smith VZ300 computer with tape drive, joysticks, and a suite haul of cassette software. You'll see all that in the last picture. So shown, tested as working, has a cartridge word processor, and then everything else is just tape based. So currently a few bids going for $70, $69 Australian, so that should be about $9.99 US, maybe a little bit more. But that's quite a nice little Dick Smith VZ300 system. You see quite a few of the earlier VZ200 systems popping up, and they have the wonderful dead flesh chiclet keyboard style.
Right.
This has proper keys on it. It's a very nice system. And just for something a little bit different, I just came across this. My favorite arcade game of all time. And
here comes another pronunciation argument.
Yes, Galaga.
All right,
Galaga,
Galaga,
Galaga.
Oh, Galaga, Galaga. I've heard, but so 32 mil button pin badges with the icons from the game. So
cool.
These are cute.
Yeah, so quite reasonably priced. So about they're $14.90 Australian. So that's just over $11 US. I'm not quite sure about delivery to you overseas folk.
I've been told it is not acceptable to try to play a real live version of this game with Michael at Kansas Fest by purchasing these buttons and throwing them at him in a hallway. I've already been told I'm not allowed to do that.
Okay. Also not allowed to unplug the game while it's being played.
I was going
to
say, you don't have a good track record playing this game with Michaels.
This is true.
This is
a McGinnis maneuver on me.
Flat rate shipping worldwide. So even here to the US, it's $6 shipping.
Yeah, cool. See, we look after you, Americans. You extort us to send all your wonderful retro computeriness over here.
But, okay, it's gone on the list.
We aren't so unkind back to you. Or either we don't have much that you want anyway. You can add computeriness to your list.
Right. It's on the list. Write it down. You've got fair usey, JPEGy, retro challengey, and computeriness.
Those are very listy words.
All right.
These are all adjectives, I believe.
They're pretty adjective-y.
Making this list of adjectives is my favorite new adjectivity.
You're my new favorite person. That's the whole reason I podcast with you, dude. That was awesome.
So I have a little pile of auctions as well. I'm not sure if I'm going to go through all the ones that I actually put in the show notes. But the first one is a ZX Evolution, ZX Spectrum compatible hobby computer board. And if I understand this, this is actually more or less what we were talking about with the Atari thing. It is a modern mini ITX shaped thing that is ZX Spectrum. Essentially, it has a couple of slots, which I assume can accept peripherals of a sort from the ZX Spectrum. It has, I think, one, I'm not sure actually what it is, but there is one I think vintage chip on here, and it looks pretty cool. It's designed by the Netto PC Group. There is some stuff online that you can read about it, but I found it confusing. So anyway, is this at all familiar to any of you?
It is not.
No.
Anyway, this looks kind of interesting. I think I've even mentioned before that I'm interested in getting a Spectrum, but it's not easy to get like a sort of a US compatible one. They're all over the place in Europe, but I don't, even if I get one, I have to figure out a way to plug it in and look at it. So,
and if you did, you could play that new game we talked about at the top of the show.
So this seems like this might be a way to get at that, is and then I think, well, I can just emulate and then it all falls apart. So, okay. The next one is a Fisher Technique, computer teach-in robot plus IBM interface parts. This I thought was pretty cool. This is, it's not complete, but it is, it's basically a robot kit for, the IBM PC platform. There's a little control box here that ends in what looks like a 25 pin connector that has to plug into something. But it looks like, it has a nice box. It might be missing some of the manuals and stuff, but, I bet these are really quite hard to find. So I know they exist for the Apple II and they're hard to find there. But
whenever I see one of these little robot kit things come up, I always covet it. And there's so few things that I actually want to have, but I love these things. Uh-huh. They go for ridiculous money though. And I don't know where I'd put it, but they're just so cool.
Yeah. I mean, even if you're not an IBM person, it's possible that this is not a bad thing to get. You might be able to use all the pieces and find the one missing piece to your platform of choice. Because its starting bid is $40. It's looks like it ships worldwide. To me,
it'll probably go for a lot more. That was due.
Yeah, perhaps. I sort of think that it might be hiding a little bit in the IBM part. I don't think most of it is IBM specific, but I think if people are not interested in IBMs, they might not see it. I don't know. We'll see. Take a look.
We'll see how much you buy it for.
Right. Yeah, I don't have one of these. So.
But yet.
Yet. Right. Okay. Next one I have is a TRS-80 Model 4P. This is the quite arduously luggable version of the TRS-80 Model 4. It's, sewing machine sized. It's
it's no Pied Piper, that's for sure.
Yeah. I think it's pretty cool, actually. I like the machine. Anyway, so it's what's kind of notable about this one. There are many of these on eBay, and in fact, actually, they often yellow in a very dramatic way. But what's kind of notable about this one is that it's got a lot of stuff with it. So it's got the manual, and it's got a little modem and a Radio Shack branded power strip. It seems like it has the cover. But what I thought was kind of interesting is it also has the box. I've never seen the box, but this has the box. And then it has a bunch of PC discs that don't really belong with it, but that's all right. You can do what you want with those. And it's shown coming up to the, you know, please insert a relevant disc screen. So starting bid is $200, so you have to really want that box. But it's neat to see the picture of the box anyway, even if you're not going to bid. I have one of these, and it's the only sort of like pre-color computer TRS-80 that I have. And it seems like, you know, I kind of like this as a way in to that world without having to get a stationary thing that takes up space on the desk, or, you know, a Model 1 that doesn't do anything.
Right.
Or a Model 2 that takes up your entire house.
Right.
Right. But if you get a Model 3 or 4, then you can get that real operating an airline check-in counter experience.
Right.
That you really can't get from other retro computers.
Okay, and another one that I thought was, it's mildly interesting, actually really just for the description. So this is an Electronica BK0010. We've talked about these before. I think the 001001 is the sort of like more popular one of these, but it's a...
Well, everyone has the 01, of course.
Yeah, yeah, like,
why even mention it? I got three of those. Jeez.
So it's a Russian, like it's a PDP-11 clone.
Because everybody needs a Russian PDP-11 clone. I'm sure glad you picked this auction.
Yep. It's, I think, essentially like the Timex Sinclair 1000, you know, in the Russian world. It just was using the PDP-11 architecture, which I think I always found that kind of weird. But so this is an earlier version of it that had just like a membrane keyboard. It's really quite terrible. And the 0010-01 had actual keys.
Oh, this keyboard is great. I'm in love with this. It's like, it's got to be like, it's like the Atari 400 sort of keyboard where it's like so beautiful to look at, but you don't actually want to touch it.
Yeah.
It looks exactly like that. It's very colorful, and it's got Cyrillic characters on it. And it's just, it's like a Jelly Bean Factory exploded all over this keyboard. It's beautiful.
It does look pretty, and this particular unit is in good shape. If you read the description, the seller is claiming that this is basically like a replacement unit for a top secret network of these things that was made into a kind of a supercomputer because they couldn't get actual supercomputers, so they took a bunch of these, essentially Timex Sinclair 1000s and network them together into a supercomputer made of bits in order to counter the Strategic Defense Initiative Star Wars program.
I would like to, at this point, announce my Russian PDP 11 clone podcast,
yep.
Which I'm going to call Computer with a K, and it's going to be a big hit. I think there's going to be a real audience for that.
I'll be rushing to listen to it.
I want to be able to kick you from this skull. There's a reason Quinn doesn't join us for the show, you know.
This is my first time here in years.
All right. So anyway, read the description. You probably don't want to bid on it. It's a $450 starting bid. So it's, it's all about the, story. But anyway, I thought it was neat to look at and interesting to read. Next thing I wanted to mention was this is one that I actually just looked for on purpose rather than just seeing what was on the list in the listings. In fact, I think the one that I picked is going to end possibly sooner than you hear this, but it's an auction for 8 issues of Soft Talk for the IBM personal computer. And I don't know if I've mentioned this here before. I probably have, but I find it actually quite an interesting magazine because I am very well familiar with the Soft Talk that existed for the Apple II, and this is kind of like a sister publication that was launched for the IBM PC. It's basically the same kind of writing, same, you know, sort of thing that it's trying to do, except that it's all about the PC. So it's like this weird alternate universe when you read this. So if you haven't...
I didn't even know this existed. Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It's it's just, it's weird. Because
it does look like I'm looking at an alternate universe, like somebody mocked up phony soft talks to deal. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I have.
That's what they did, and now they're selling it on eBay for $56.
Yeah.
Totally worth every penny.
Nope, they are for real. I have the full run, of course, and I've been trying.
Which is also Australian slag.
Should see a doctor about that.
If you get the full run, you know you're in trouble.
I'm just going to keep going here.
You can try.
I have been trying to make my way through the scanning of these. I think I may be one of the only people trying to scan them, so I will have to try to make it to the end of it. It's actually by now possible to get all the soft talks for the Apple II, which was like one of the big players for the Apple II platform on archive.org, so we'll have a link to those. But I've only scanned a couple of the soft talk for the IBM PCs, and I have, I've got a page where they're going to go, and a couple of them are there, so I'll provide that link. But they're not there yet. But anyway, very interesting. And I think I'll leave it at that. We can now turn to the closing discussions. And Carrington, you have something down there.
I had the complete run. I'm better now. Yes, a couple of things. The first was, I got the impression that we either talked about this or it's not new or something, but it seems to be new or new again. After Dark, the screensaver, famous for its floating toast or flying toasters and that sort of thing, has been implemented strictly in CSS. So there's a website we will link to. You can go there and you can have flying toasters or fish or that globe thing, and just bring back the After Dark memories. Just in a website, not particularly useful as a screensaver because it doesn't go full screen. It's just in the page of a web browser, but still a neat implementation. So if you want a quick hit of flying toasters or you want to leave something up on your screen when you walk away, what the heck? I think it's pretty cool and it's very well implemented. So well done. And then that brings us to another quick little addition here. There's Sleep Mode, the art of the screensaver, which is an online art installation by a fellow named Raphael Rosendahl, I think it's pronounced. It's a bunch of screensavers, kind of an essay about screensavers, and it will make you feel very old if you know what a screensaver is, because this is clearly created and presented from the point of view of somebody who came after screensavers. So it's a lot of descriptions about what a screensaver is, and they've discovered like what the reason was it for. And if you know you're old enough to remember when there was burn-in and the need for screensavers, and you sort of take them for granted as just a thing that existed, no big deal. But it's weird to see something that was just, you know, a part of my life and it just doesn't exist anymore because we don't really need them, but it's just a thing. Everybody knows what screensavers are. This is point of the view of like, I've discovered this weird thing that used to exist called a screensaver. And it's like, it's bizarre. So I read through this during the show. It made me feel super old. And so now I will include the link in the show notes so you can feel old as well.
Nice. I was once in a band and one of the songs that we played was the Flying Toaster theme song. So there you go.
Nice.
There I go.
Did you write that? Did you compose it or is there actually
so one of the later versions of After Dark, the Flying Toaster thing, there was a song and it would play it and it was like a march and it put the words at the bottom of the screen and a bouncing ball and yeah.
Huh. I never knew that.
No one remembers this. Yeah. Yeah. It was like not the initial, you know, original early version, but it was like After Dark 3.0 or something. Let's see. I had to look at the lyrics because I only remember some of them. Flying out of the sun, the smell of toast is in the air. When there's a job to be done, the flying toasters will be there. And it's flap, flap, flap. Now help is on the way. A victory song they sing. We pop up to save the day on flying toaster wings. Yeah.
I submit that would be a far better national anthem than like 90% of the countries have now. If I ever rise up and take over the government of Canada, that is totally getting implemented. That'd be amazing. I can see the flag now, so it's starting to be great. I also remember I liked the games in After Dark, the screensaver that like there was eventually like Moen Maniac and I think it was called Lunatic Fringe, the space one. Those were super awesome games just implemented inside a screensaver. Very, very handy for installation at work.
Huh.
Handy.
I have this feeling I stopped using After Dark. There was some other one that I used because I think it was free or something. There was some problem with why I couldn't keep using After Dark. But
the Business Software Association were chasing you for unpaid license fees.
Perhaps. Interesting.
So did you never play Lunatic Fringe then?
No, I don't think...
It was super good. It was a really good space shooter game built into After Dark.
It says a Maelstrom-like game. Yeah, no, I don't think I've ever seen this. I've heard, for some reason, yep. I feel like I've heard of it, but...
Highly recommended. It was actually... I was totally hooked on it. It was really good.
Huh. Excellent. Well, something to do for later. All right. Kevin, what have you been up to? You've been up to many things.
I've been up to many things. My most interesting thing that just started today was that I received a big box of... flyers and brochures and spec sheets and stuff I received them from Jason Scott, but they originally belonged to Ted Nelson, and he had collected all of this stuff from various companies, and I'm scanning it and spanning, say, 1962 through the mid 80s. Just an amazing, amazing collection of stuff that is going to take probably days and weeks to scan. Spec sheets for Nixie tubes and punch card readers and here, Mr. Nelson, here's the information you wanted about the control data of such and such computer, and just piles and piles and piles of stuff. So that's been interesting, and you'll start to see that appear on archive.org soon. That's going to be an expensive and time consuming project. So I'm willing to accept help on that. Basically, I'm doing some of it, but I'm throwing a person at it who is going to be expensive. I mean, she's not that expensive, but it's going to take a lot of time anyway, so it's going to get expensive. Let's see. I'm currently playing Starcross with Carrington for Eaten by a Gru.
I'm playing it too.
Are you? Yay! So, yeah, playing a lot of InfoComm games with Carrington, and that's fun. And I've been doing a lot of interviews for the Antic podcast. Upcoming interviews that I have done but have not been published yet include the inventor of the Koalapad and the founder of Artworks Software.
Very cool. Yeah, actually, might also be worth mentioning that you just released the David All and Betsy All interview on the Antic feed. But that was super interesting and a little hard to hear in some places, but very, very interesting. So Creative Computing Magazine, if I didn't say that.
Right. Yeah. That's as I said in the introduction to the thing, to the interview, it's an interview I did with Dave and Betsy All 3 years ago when I thought I might be writing a book about the first computer magazines. And I decided not to write that book, but I am releasing the interviews. And basically, I talked with Dave and Betsy for 3.5 hours, and it's a really fascinating interview. And they just open up and told me everything. In the first maybe hour of it, a little hard to hear because we recorded it in a bar at a hotel because this wasn't meant for you. It was meant for me to be notes for a book. So, but it's pretty listenable, especially after we change venues and it's in a nice quiet house. So, but yeah, I love that interview. They are great people.
Yeah, and we definitely appreciate your letting us hear it. Let's see, what was I going to say? Thimbleweed Park was the thing you just did on, the last published Eaten by a Gru. That's the first one that I actually stopped before when we hit the spoiler fence. So, at some point I'm going to have to play this and then I'll hear the rest of it. And until then, it's going to sit there mocking me in my podcast list. Yeah,
right. That's one definitely, if you haven't played the game and think maybe you definitely don't go past the spoiler fence.
All right.
Yeah, that was a fun game. And easier than StarCross.
Oh my goodness. Also more humor than StarCross. StarCross is a game that takes itself very seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does.
I'm digging it, but holy moly, it's tough.
Excellent. Michael, what's happening with you?
Well, not much in active retro computer, but I've been taking my new scanner through its features, so setting up the various profiles for the different sizes and things. So, been running through some old Ringbinder programming manuals, and there was also a collection of VZ200 and VZ300 articles and projects, which I haven't been able to find online anywhere, so I've been scanning those, and I'll be pushing those up to the Internet Archive and other places as well. So, I'm very glad that I got this scanner, especially the being able to scan things which are A3 sized or a little bit larger. Nice feature that I found. I can scan in A4 saddle-stapled documents and just scan them in as A3 and automatically split them down to A4, which will make them a lot easier to put up into the archive.
Sweet. Cool.
It means I don't have to chop them. I just have to pull out the staples, scan them, and then I can put the staples back in and put them up on the bookshelf.
So do you know, is A3 sort of like tabloid? I mean, I don't have a concept of A3.
That's right. This is an international paper standard. A3 is the same size as two sheets of A4 side by side on the long edge. So that's
how metric works.
I'm not quite sure what tabloid is as far as a size. So really, if you've got two sheets of letter and you put them side by side on the long edge, that's roughly what an A3 is. So it can go for oversized A3.
Yeah, yeah. And that's tabloid's the same two letter size next to each other. Cool. Okay, let's see. I've done a couple of things. I did a little bit of moving stuff around in my office, which led me to actually what happened is I found a cart, one of these things that in elementary school or whatever you would wheel in the equipment with the big TV on the top, and it has several tiers and a power strip on the side and wheels, and someone discarded this, and so I said, I will take this, and I used this to place some of my sort of like larger computers on in a tiered way. And so I sort of set up some stuff that's a little bit more displayable. I've tested Lisa 2, and I've assembled an Apple 3 Plus out of like various bits I've upgraded my 2GS. So I've tested a Mac Cube and a Color Classic. I've got all of them except the Lisa 2 up and running. The Lisa 2 doesn't start. I think the power supply is no longer. And in fact, I think I know when that happened, because there was a time when I came into my office and it smelled like there was a capacitor problem. Mm. And I think the capacitor went even when the thing was off. Like it was plugged in, but it was not on. And I think there's a little bit of a trickle charge that keeps something going in the Lisa. And oh yeah, that's right, because it has a soft power on, so it has to be awake enough to be able to hear you hit the button, so I can, you know, do whatever it does to turn on the power. But it's not actually a physical circuit connection. Anyway, whatever. So, but that was kind of fun. I actually had a chance to like see the Cube working, see the Color Classic working. I installed some new memory in the 2GS and. I got one of these Wi-Fi 232 things. I think I mentioned it last time as it was about to arrive. It did arrive, and it's pretty cool. I called the level 29 BBS both from a 2E and from the 3 Plus. Nice.
Yeah, I got the Wi-Fi adapter thingy. I have it here. I have not tried it yet, but it's tiny. It's smaller than I guessed it would be. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's barely bigger than a quarter. Anyway, it's awesome.
I think that is really cool. I mean, like the fact that you can just take it from computer to computer. I mean, it's pretty much platform agnostic. So I will probably need to get more of these. I actually could play network games, I suppose.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay. And anyone else have anything else they want to say before I close off the show?
Retro compute.
Hold on.
I just wanted to get it in first, you know, while I could.
Yep. First. All right. So let's. Well, I'll call that the end of the stuff and say that that's it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, and you can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send us feedback by email at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review on iTunes. It will help other people find the show, and it will also add to the, like, I think two or something that we have at the moment. I finally did look at them, and they're old and not numerous. So at any rate. Okay, all right. Ready now? Until next
Retro
time.
Retro Commute! Oh, wait.
Hold on.
Eager fellow.
And until next time...
Retro Commute!
Nice to have you here.
Never will be invited back again. Flying out of the sun, the smell of toast is in the air,